Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Coming up on the show, we take a deeper look into how the Wyoming Game and Fish Department is funded and whether it needs to change.
And the Wyoming Game and Fish Commission's budget is about 75% hunter and angler dollars.
The coroner who attended Matthew Shepard's funeral has never spoken to the media until now. She says she has good reasons to believe it was a hate crime.
To me, that just brings a lot of red flags up.
We'll also hear about reduced transparency in the Fish and Wildlife Service and less access to documents relating to the Endangered Species Act.
We'll also talk to the Libertarian candidate for governor and hear a spooky Halloween tale. Those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. After a controversial year, the Yellowstone grizzlies are back on the threatened species list. The issue is frustrating to state officials because the state has to fund the majority of grizzly management. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska explains.
Contrary to what many people think, animals under Endangered Species Act protections are not fully funded by the federal government, but by the state the species lives in. Brian Nesvik, the Wyoming Game and Fish Department's chief game warden, says the department has spent over $50 million since the grizzly bear was put on the list almost 40 years ago.
It comes from the commission's budget, and the Wyoming Game and Fish Commission's budget is about 75% hunter and angler dollars.
Nesvik says the federal government only contributes about 5% of the funding toward the grizzly's recovery, which means Wyoming hunters and anglers foot the bill.
Thanks to their efforts, the species is recovered. There's extra bears. There's opportunity.
That opportunity? Hunting. Jackson resident Lisa Robertson is a wildlife advocate. She says federal protections for the grizzly are not just a Wyoming issue.
It doesn't fly anymore with the public. The tourists that come here to watch animals do not want to see those animals trophy hunted for any reason.
Robertson says the Shoot 'Em with a Camera initiative, where thousands of people applied for grizzly bear hunt licenses to hunt with a camera, proves that there is a group of people who are willing to contribute to the department but don't want to hunt or fish.
They need to respond to those people and react. What are they going to do with these people now that are signing up to be involved or to donate to projects that are not related to trophy hunting?
The current funding model for wildlife management is known as the North American Model of Wildlife Conservation. It is a set of principles that have been followed since President Teddy Roosevelt's time, and it basically says we need to protect wildlife to ensure a viable population to fish and hunt. So this includes hunter and angler license fees, but also federal excise taxes on hunting and fishing equipment. For Joe Condalise, who is the president of the Western Bear Foundation, this model works, but he also agrees that the Game and Fish Department needs more diverse funding. However, he is worried that allowing non-consumptive users will change the way things are done in Wyoming.
Why else would they want to spend the money? They want to spend money to influence decisions. That's it.
The chairman of the governor's task force on fish and wildlife funding is Ryan Lance. He says it's a tricky issue since licenses don't generate enough revenue since Game and Fish manages more than just game species.
If we're going to be able to maintain state lands, if you're going to be able to maintain and enhance recreational opportunities in the state, there's going to have to be a broader pool of funds to draw from.
Lance says it's been difficult to find consensus on a solution, noting that excise taxes on outdoor equipment and non-consumptive user conservation stamps are among the suggestions to generate revenue. The legislature has not been part of the solution. It has rejected using additional state general fund money for game and fish, and in 2017, it cut existing state funds and increased all license fees to compensate. State Representative Albert Summers says Game and Fish does need new revenue sources.
I do believe that there are certain issues out there, certain species that, because of court cases and the national attention on them, that there should be national dollars put towards them.
The Wyoming legislature passed a resolution last legislative session asking the National Park Service and neighboring states to look at creating a wildlife user fee for people that enter Yellowstone National Park so that they can possibly get those federal dollars. But while Summers wants the federal government to contribute, he doesn't want Wyoming to lose control of management. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Two stories making waves in energy and environmental circles this week take place within federal agencies. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaks with experts to give context. Up first, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service released a staff directive making it more difficult for the public to obtain important documents from them. McKim speaks with Noah Greenwald, the Endangered Species Director of the Center for Biological Diversity. Greenwald says the Fish and Wildlife Service controversy all started with a leaked memo.
So this leaked memo is from Secretary Ryan Zinke and Department of Interior, and it directs Fish and Wildlife Service staff to withhold documents from the public, and in particular documents expressing the opinions of their scientists that then lead to a decision. So like an example would be a decision about listing or delisting a species like the grizzly bear as a threatened or endangered species. So if one of their scientists were to say, I don't think they're fully recovered, they shouldn't be delisted, grizzly bears, they're instructing their staff to withhold those kind of communications from the public.
So did it specifically cite Endangered Species Act related documents, or is this just anything that comes out of Fish and Wildlife Service?
You know, in this memo, they talk about some cases where documents got to the public that they didn't like. So like documents related to the Keystone XL pipeline, they felt like documents shouldn't have been released. And then they talked about cases where documents had been successfully withheld and that was good.
Have there ever been any cases where groups like Center for Biological Diversity have FOIA'd and used these documents or have been useful for public use?
Yeah, for sure. For example, when we overturned delisting of Yellowstone grizzly bears, you know, we were relying on the record in that case and documents that we got through the Freedom of Information Act, you know, or there's a species in Arizona called the Cactus ferruginous pygmy owl that had been denied protection. And we got a hold of a draft finding where the agency's own scientists said it should have been protected. So that's an example of, you know, that document was critical to us being able to make the case that it should have been protected and that their denial was arbitrary.
Do you see this decision? Well, it's not a decision. Could you actually put it in context of where it is right now as far as becoming a reality?
You know, it's a directive to the staff to withhold these quote unquote deliberative documents. More stuff will be withheld. In some cases, we won't even know that they were withheld. You know, this is something we're certainly going to challenge and look for ways to challenge. It's both against the Freedom of Information Act as well as against the spirit of open government and transparency.
It seems like there's already been a strong response. I've seen a bunch of reports about this, including in Congress, obviously, to the Fish and Wildlife Service move. Do you think that this directive will hold long term, or will it have to take a court to actually change it?
I think, you know, that it's not going to hold long term. And actually, open government and transparency is actually a bipartisan issue. Both Democrats and Republicans support that. And so I think eventually through congressional oversight and the courts, this policy won't hold.
So we were just speaking with Noah Greenwald. Over to a new topic, coal and the power plants that burn it. Those plants are closing in unprecedented numbers. In June, President Trump took a step to change that. Taylor Kirkendall is a coal reporter with S&P Global Market Intelligence. Could you start by explaining a little bit about this subsidy plan introduced last June?
The basic idea is that the Department of Energy would like to intervene into the energy markets and basically either order grid operators to buy electricity from struggling coal and nuclear plants or they would provide some sort of an incentive to do so. And currently, a lot of those plants are retiring because it's cheaper to get energy from elsewhere. And so what the DOE is kind of doing here is making a national defense or a national security argument that basically gives wide deference to the administration and would allow them to come in and intervene in those markets, put their thumb on the scale and support both coal and nuclear plants that otherwise might not dispatch.
So how would this theoretically affect states, coal-dependent states like Wyoming, who have seen several of their customers leave the coal markets to natural gas and renewables?
Right, so it's going to be really tough to see any of those plants come back online, even with this sort of drastic proposal that we've heard here. Obviously, one of the biggest problems that these coal companies face and what we're hearing from both the trade groups, the coal companies themselves, and other organizations that are pro-coal, is that one of their top priorities right now is preserving the existing fleet. I think as much as they would love to see new coal customers come online and have an outlet for that coal, more than anything, they really just want to hold on to what they got. And that's basically what this proposal is aimed at.
So this proposal has not been taken too seriously, it seems. It's kind of stalled out. Why is that?
The kind of consensus of the problem is that a lot of people that are outside of the coal industry really don't think that this proposal is necessary. Unprecedented opposition. I mean, you saw, oil companies, natural gas companies, renewable energy companies all band together and say they don't need this. Even some utilities that have coal plants in their fleet don't like this idea of intervening in the market. But then, of course, like recent reports that we're seeing now are that even internally, the Trump administration's having difficulty selling, even its own staff on some of these proposals.
So now Energy Secretary Rick Perry, who's been the force behind this proposal, brought it up again last week in front of reporters saying it's still possible. You could still see this proposal. He's still committed to it. What are your thoughts on that?
I think you're going to see some sort of proposal eventually come out. Whether that's successful or not is yet to be seen. So I don't think there's a lot to lose by putting this out there. I think that there might be some questions of timing, whether they're going to put this out before midterm elections or wait till after. But I think you're almost definitely going to see something eventually come out.
Anything else that we're missing in this discussion before we wrap it up?
No, I mean, I think one of the major things that's not talked about a lot on the support side is that this is probably going to be a very costly proposal, and anything that we've seen so far doesn't really detail who's going to pay for it or how they're going to pay for it. It would make sense that this is somehow passed on to consumers in some way. Cost estimates that we've seen have ranged from a couple hundred million up to several billion, depending on how the plan actually shakes out. But that's going to be, I think, a big part of what's going to keep this from actually being successful is that someone's got to pay for it, and that's going to be pretty politically damaging, I would think, and a risk that maybe they don't want to take ahead of the midterms. But again, I just think that there's so much invested in trying to save the coal industry. I would find it hard to believe that at least some sort of proposal doesn't come out.
Great. Well, thanks for joining me, Taylor, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
That was energy reporter Cooper McKim speaking with Taylor Kuykendall about a subsidy that could keep struggling coal and nuclear plants online. And before that, Noah Greenwald on controversial changes within the Fish and Wildlife Service.
When we return, we'll hear from Lawrence Strumpf, Wyoming's Libertarian candidate for governor. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Lawrence Strumpf is Wyoming's Libertarian candidate for governor. Dr. Strumpf is a native of Fremont County who has a doctorate in instructional technology from the University of Wyoming. He's an educator, an avid gun owner, and outdoorsman, and very active in the Laramie community. Strumpf tells Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck that working with a variety of organizations opens his eyes up at the needs in Wyoming.
I've been working with the Albany County Suicide Prevention Task Force. And when you look at the mental health in the state of Wyoming and that there is no regulation, there is no funding for it. And here in Laramie, we have a good group of people that are doing it locally. But there needs to be some sort of state standard and some funding applied to it because there's just a terrible youth suicide crisis going on and other mental health from substance abuse to sexual abuse and other things of that nature. And and the state needs to get involved in and help the communities around the state.
I would think, especially when you look at places like Peak Wellness and some of those outfits that have a sliding fee scale, because a lot of people just frankly can't afford $100 an hour or something along those lines.
Correct. And it is important to get companies and businesses that are currently working in that area to integrate and work with it, but there needs to be some sort of state-based guidance and structure for that.
One of the things also out there I want to certainly ask you about is in the area of healthcare. Lots of concern right now about rising healthcare costs. You know, people have been able to get insurance, but there's a lot of very high deductibles out there, which, you know, in some cases only makes it really catastrophic insurance that people have. What can we do in this state to maybe address some of those things?
Well, there's a number of things. First of all, it is crazy, ridiculous that we have not expanded Medicaid yet. We're one of the few states in the nation that hasn't done it. I've spoken with, you know, hospital managers and board members, and they pretty much all agree that it would help them and it would lower medical costs to expand Medicaid, that people don't have preventive care. So over 20,000 people in Wyoming are getting to where they're so bad they have to go to the emergency room for treatment. And then when they treat them, it's a much greater cost, and then they have to push those costs onto other customers. So the people aren't as healthy, and it increases the costs. Another issue is the opioid epidemic. I mean, it's terrible. So many people are hooked on pharmaceutical drugs or opioids, and by pushing the medical marijuana, which is you can go to WebMD or any viable research for medical for medicine, all support, you know, the medical marijuana for pain relief and for epilepsy and stuff of that nature.
Lauren Strump visiting with us. He's your Libertarian candidate for governor. It's a topic that you get every debate you go to, and it's on this issue of taxation. It's on the issue of getting more revenue into the state. Now, I've interviewed a lot of Libertarians over the years, Lawrence. I have not heard too many people say that they like taxes. I'm curious where you stand on this.
Well, I'm a modern Libertarian, and modern Libertarian, you have to look at where you are. Now, we're not looking at where we were 200 years ago. We have wonderful national parks and public lands and public education and wonderful services that make America great that we've worked and fought and died for over 200 years to build. And we're not going to just get rid of those. It's not going to happen. And we have a tax-based society. The way the government works is through taxes. And I do agree that we do need to figure out a way to increase revenue for the state, or we're going to have to do great cuts. And so with my studies and research, the best focus of that would be property tax. Right now, as an average at the state, we're 0.61%, which is lower than pretty much everyone else in the nation. South Dakota's at 1.3%, and Nebraska's at 1.8%, I believe. And so if we increased it from 0.61% to 1%, that would, you know, greatly increase our state's revenue.
Lawrence Strump visiting with us again, Libertarian candidate for governor. In the final couple minutes we have, I want to talk about Endow and the efforts to diversify the economy. What I get when I get pushback from people is that this maybe isn't something that government should be heavily involved in. And in fact, that's why we developed the Wyoming Business Council. I'm kind of curious your thoughts on that.
Well, they're two separate focuses. So the Wyoming Business Council does wonderful things, which you can see here in Laramie with the Citrus Sky Technology Park and all of the businesses they've helped come and grow within Laramie and across Wyoming. The Endow is more of a think tank that researched and identified opportunities and cost for Wyoming. And a lot of their ideas are good. Rob Godby, professor at University of Wyoming, really identified the need for Wyoming to develop a renewable standard portfolio to help promote and attract wind energy, which right now is the most cost-effective, profitable energy source in the nation. And we have a window to attract those. And so it's really critical that our next governor create a renewable portfolio standard, or renewable standard portfolio, to attract this wind energy. And of course, wind energy is one of the issues identified in the Endow. One thing I really wanted to touch on was Wyoming Promise. Mm-hmm. It is so critical that if we're going to have an effective government, we have to break this two-party system that's financed by super PACs and, you know, the finance money. I really want to make sure that whoever the next governor is really supports and pushes Wyoming Promise to get a 28th Amendment, which would overturn Citizens United and identify that corporations are not people, and get corporate money out of the election process.
And again, just wanted to have you clarify that we're talking about limiting campaign money.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy when, you know, you can pretty much buy an election. You can look at the money in the election process, and whoever has the most money is pretty much going to win. And, you know, that's corporate money. There aren't, you know, individuals that are throwing in $3 million into an election fund.
Lauren Strump, always a pleasure having you stop by. He's your Libertarian candidate for governor, and we do wish you well. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we'll hear an interview with a coroner who attended Matthew Shepard's autopsy. You are listening to Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. After Matthew Shepard's murder, his autopsy was filed away and never released to the public. Julie Hagee was the coroner at the time. She says she decided, along with law enforcement and the county attorney's office, that was the best thing to protect the report from mass distribution.
The law enforcement that was involved at the time, as well as myself and the county attorney, had conversations and decided that any release of the autopsy report should be released by only one entity.
And that was the county attorney's office. Wyoming Public Radio recently made a request to see the autopsy after all these years. Hagee has never talked publicly about her experience of conducting Shepard's autopsy until now. I sat down with her to hear why she says some details in the report make it clear to her this was a hate crime. A warning, this conversation may not be appropriate for all audiences.
Being a lesbian myself, I was very conscious of what I was going into and very much wanted to make sure we crossed all the T's and dotted the I's.
Matthew Shepard lived for 6 days in a Fort Collins hospital before he died. The autopsy says the cause of death was multiple injuries resulting from blunt trauma to the head and face.
Basically, he died in a different county, a different state, Larimer County, Colorado. It just happens that they would turn the case back over to the county that the injuries were sustained in. And so that brought it back to Albany County, which then I was the one that lined up the autopsy and allowed that to go forward.
And so, you know, going into it, what was your reaction to seeing this young man's body after this terrible beating?
Well, it was horrific, quite frankly. I had not seen a beating of this magnitude, and although, there were a lot of things during my tenure as the coroner that I did see, but nothing of this magnitude, no.
Is there anything in the autopsy that really shows that maybe this was a hate crime?
Well, honestly, I guess one of the things that comes back to me is that there was a lot of bruising on Matthew's body, and most specifically bruising in the genital region. To me, that just brings a lot of red flags up, and that somebody did endure that type of treatment or pain, and then later the beating he had to have endured.
According to court testimony, Shepard's assailants, Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson, lured Shepard out of a bar and into their truck. They said they wanted to rob him, but as they were driving, Shepard put his hand in McKinney's lap. That's when McKinney snapped. Hagee says This is when she believes that the bruising to Shepard's groin and genitals would have happened. Previously, people believed that bruising happened after he was tied to the fence, that he'd been kicked. But Hagee says those bruises were fingerprint-shaped.
I would say that it was more hands and fingers. It seemed more likely that the bruising took place possibly while he was detained. So I think maybe some grabbing and that sort of thing. And in my opinion, had to be quite forceful to
leave bruises. Hagee says this sexual assault on Shepard in the truck is why she's convinced the crime was motivated by hate and not money or drugs. You know, a lot of people are talking about this issue that it, maybe it wasn't a hate crime because there was drugs involved. I wonder if you can, looking at the autopsy, see any signs that he maybe had drugs in his system when he was found.
It appears that he may have had some antidepressants in his system, as well as possible marijuana and alcohol. But the alcohol levels, quite frankly, don't seem to be extraordinary in any sense.
And Hagee says the toxicology report also showed no meth, no cocaine, no opioids in Shepard's system. I asked her what her role was after the autopsy.
I do remember visiting with his mother and helping her get some things together for the funeral service they had in Casper.
That's right, so, yeah. You had mentioned that you were kind of disappointed that there wasn't more financial help for her.
Absolutely. I feel like if anybody was a victim of a crime, it was Matthew Shepard. And I was very disappointed that the victim witness program did not cover his funeral expenses.
Do they normally cover expenses like that?
Absolutely.
How did that those funeral expenses end up getting paid?
I took care of those charges.
Why'd you do that?
I just knew that his family wasn't going to be responsible for those charges. I just preferred to do that. I don't know what the reasoning was that the crime victims did not take care of these charges, but I wasn't going to let that family down.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you run into them ever since
Never.
Then?
Never. It does feel good in being able to say that I honestly believe it was a hate crime, but I just like to put out there that I think everybody knows this was a hate crime. I think people are lying to themselves if they believe this is not a hate crime.
That was former Albany County Coroner Julie Hagee, who conducted the autopsy of Matthew Shepard. You can also hear an earlier interview on our website in which Hagee and her partner share the effects the murder had on their personal lives.
The Northern Arapaho elders have long searched for a way to teach the Arapaho language. They also want to educate people about how the University of Wyoming campus is part of the tribe's original homeland. Now, they've collaborated with University of Wyoming faculty and students to create a game for the iPhone. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner gave the game a try. I walked to the Native American Research Center on the University of Wyoming's campus. I'm meeting Phineas Kelly, an anthropology doctoral student who plans to show me this new game called Arapaho Language App. This is a place-based app that uses geolocation to advance in the game. I'm looking forward to seeing it because even though I'm Northern Arapaho and my grandma spoke our language fluently, I don't know how to speak it. Kelly is indigenous Rapa Nui of Easter Island and is the app's creator. He says the game works like Pokemon Go. He brings out his iPhone and opens up the app.
Arapaho, because the intent of the game is to give people the experience of the UW campus as actually being Arapaho land, which it still is. Mm-hmm.
Then he reads to me.
Welcome, this is Arapaho land. The earth, the plants, animals, and everything from the breath of the wind to the warmth of the sun are alive. Go find Badger.
Where is Badger?
Badger's right over there.
We start walking and I find out that Badger is an important animal because of his connection to the roots of the earth. Badger finds us and we are notified on the screen.
Then we learned how to say badger.
Wah-aw is considered an especially powerful animal because of its command over both the space above the earth and the space below it. Wah-aw is ceremonially important because of his digging ability and said to be the possessor of the medicinal roots that grow below the earth.
After we meet Badger and collect the medicine, we walk across campus to find Crow and learn about what respect means to the Arapaho people. Crow flies above Prexy's pasture, and Kelly reads out loud.
Once you learn to respect yourself, then you will truly be able to respect other people. And when your thoughts, words, and actions toward yourself and others show respect, then you will be respected. Do you hear? Do you understand?
After learning about the Arapaho traditional values of respect from Crow, we find a cottonwood tree to sit under to collect more medicine.
Anyway, I want to read this to you because it's really cool.
Oh, yeah. Then I learn how stars come from the earth through the cottonwood trees, because the spirit of the night sky asks the wind to shake the branches to release the stars into the sky.
So if you just take any, you know, cottonwood branch, basically, I'll have to find a drier one, but the stars are actually right inside.
Oh my god. That is amazing. When he broke apart the cottonwood branch, there was a star right in the center. After learning about different plants and animals, we collect our medicine and try to find Grandmother to complete this level of the game. Robin Lopez teaches Arapaho at the University of Wyoming, and she worked with the elders of the Arapaho tribe to make the application as precise as possible. She says that the elders have grown more accepting of using new technology to teach the language in recent years.
So the elders are super on board now. They like the students having access to things, but now they're so excited about this that they want more. So they want this same thing, this place-based app, multiple places. So they would like it to go with each school on the reservation. So that's like a potential future path for this.
She says that it's important to build spaces for the language to reside because there are only 200 people who speak Arapaho fluently today. Language revitalization is an intergenerational task, and she is one of the 200 fluent Arapaho speakers. Hello, I'm Hisaisi Nibe, Robin Lopez. I am a teacher at the University of Wyoming. Back out on the university campus with the app, we have finished the first stage. At the end of the first level, you find Grandmother and can give her all the medicine that you've collected. Then you can listen to her story. Phineas holds up the phone to my ear so I can hear.
At the beginning of Plymouth Rock, of the Mayflower, of the three ships, Columbus, and was the beginning of our demise. And I remember when I was in ninth grade and I was getting excited about being in high school, I opened my history book. The first sentence, Native Americans were savages. What was I supposed to think of myself? I'm a savage? I don't think so. I didn't make good grades in history.
Language is a vital part of the Northern Arapaho culture. Through games and technology, we are seeing a new generation exposed to the values and language of the Arapaho. Hachana Habethan. That means goodbye. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Stagner.
It's election season, and on November 6th, Wyomingites will have the chance to participate in what's arguably the most local election of all, the local school board. With me to discuss some of the hot topics in school board elections across the state is education reporter Tennessee Watson. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Tennessee, can you start with the basics of what a school board does?
Sure. So the school board is the legal entity that's charged with governing a school district. And it's their responsibility to make sure that school districts run efficiently and effectively. They oversee the budget, so they sign off on how money is spent, and they make sure that public funds are being used to adequately serve kids. So they're going to look at school conditions, they're going to look at student achievement, they're going to make sure that students have the resources that they need to do the best that they can. They also provide a bridge between the local community and district administrators. So they take input from their community and they sort of help to set the course that the district is going to take. And in Wyoming, which favors local control, districts have a lot of say. And they're also advocates. They're in a position to be proactive about issues that impact their district. So that could mean engaging with town and county officials, or even traveling to Cheyenne to engage with state legislators. So they're really bringing the concerns of their local district, and they're connecting it to all of these different levels. And I think that's one of the questions for me that often is overlooked. How do they see that role as an advocate? Are they engaged with local politics? Are they talking to county commissioners? Are they willing to get in the car and drive to Cheyenne? And how are they thinking about how they're going to engage with politics at all of these different levels?
What about at the school district level? What are some key issues that we're seeing across the state?
I think a really important conversation right now is school safety and security. And school boards are empowered in Wyoming to help define their district's approach to this issue. It's gotten a lot of attention because now school districts can decide whether teachers and staff can conceal carry. But there's also a lot of other ways that they can look at this issue. Are candidates thinking about outside intrusion? Are they also thinking about personal safety within school? Are they thinking about bullying and mental health and suicide? So voters could suss out whether candidates are really pushing a singular solution or if they're taking a more holistic approach.
Another race happening besides school board races this year is the governor's race. And in debates for the gubernatorial election, education issues are coming up a lot. We've heard about K through 12's role in teaching technical skills that help prepare students to enter the workforce. How are school boards factoring into that conversation?
Yeah, career and technical education, or CTE, has been a really hot topic. And school boards do have the potential to influence this. There are schools in more populated parts of the state that can tap into local resources and offer a variety of CTE courses, from welding to automotive to culinary arts to agriculture. But for more remote and less urban districts, those options could be more limited. And in those places, the school board plays an important role in, you know, building a bridge to local community resources, but also if they have to make a choice, setting the priority. And that means reaching out to local employers to figure out what skills are most useful. It also requires some future visioning about where is our local economy going and how can our students play a role in that transition. So that's a pretty exciting and important conversation that school board members can play a role in facilitating.
Sort of on the other end of K through 12, there's been a lot of discussion about early childhood and pre-K. How's that coming in?
Well, I think folks are thinking about whether this needs to be implemented across the state. And sometimes it's thought of as a statewide issue. You know, is the state going to take action? Will they provide funding for this to happen in every community? And in the meantime, if this is something that districts value, there are some creative things that they can do on the local level. If a district is part of what's called a Board of Cooperative Education Services, or a BOCES, then the school board can levy mills for additional educational resources. And that means that they could get extra special education services, but they could also use that money through BOCES for early childhood education. And we've seen at least one school district do that. So a lot of creative stuff can happen at the local level, but that means that school board members really need to understand how education policy and budgeting works. The more that they understand the system, the more creative they can be about getting resources for their community.
Is there an issue you, Tennessee Watson, are particularly excited to watch?
Yeah, I think given the prevalence of conversations about sexual violence in the context of the Me Too movement, I am interested to see what school districts do about that across the state. Studies say that kids 7 to 13 are the most vulnerable to abuse. And during the 2018 session, the legislature passed Senate File 93, which allows school districts to implement sexual abuse prevention and education. It's sort of an invitation from policymakers to school districts. So I'm interested this year to see if school districts pick that up, if there's any candidates coming in that are particularly interested in that issue.
Tennessee Watson is Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ahead, we'll finish up the show with stories about a famous Colorado River explorer and get a fright from a Halloween story set in a Utah wilderness. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Most people know John Wesley Powell as the first man to travel through the Grand Canyon. But as author of The Promise of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell's Perilous Journey and His Vision for the American West, John F. Ross found out that adventure inspired Powell to re-envision water usage in the West. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska speaks to Ross on how Powell believed his first trip down the Grand Canyon was a failure, but still inspired him later in life.
For him, that was, you know, he had lived, but it was a failure because all of their barometers had got broken, all of their maps were ruined, all of the data that they were taking with sextants, all sorts of things was all ruined because they, at the end, were just, you know, running out of food and racing for their lives. I mean, it was a terrible close call. So what did he do? And I think this is really indicative of his character. He went back and he did it again and did it right this time in terms of his data measuring and all like that. And it's an exciting story, but nowhere near the first run, as it never is. But he built on that to then, because he surveyed the river, to survey the Colorado Plateau. And then he kind of worked on that and transformed that to help start and found the U.S. Geological Survey, serve as its second director, and really begin then to open up much larger conversations about the West. And he was a very effective communicator. He went, and one of his most incredible things I think he did was he went in front of the National Academy of Sciences, the great gray beards of the scientists, the most influential scientists of the day in the 1870s. And he pulled out a map and he had drawn a line on the map and it had bisected the United States, from California kind of going up to Canada through Oklahoma, all the way up through the Dakotas, and it's generally along the 100th meridian. And he said, this gentleman, because they were men at that point, this gentleman is a really important line to look at. And I looked at it, and he said, this is an isohydrate. Well, what is that? It's a rain line. And it's an interesting thing that to the east of that, from that line east, you get 20 more inches of rain a day, a year. To the west, you get 20 inches more, less. Why is that important? Conventional agriculture needs at least 20 inches, unless it's helped by irrigation. And there's not very much water west of that line. So what he did with this map is he visually and graphically reimagined the American continent. People were thinking about railroads and political boundaries, and he said, "This is a let's look at this from a climate point of view." And he really it was a revolutionary new way of looking at the Earth. I mean, akin to, if you can imagine it, in the 60s when the astronauts came back and had pictures of the fragile Earth. It was profoundly revolutionary in that nature. He started developing things, thinking about concern that if we kind of continued a rampant development of the West without regard for sustainable development of water and land, that we would be headed toward possibly democracy threatening end results, litigation over water, monopolies, all sorts of things like that. People's dreams ruined, the small farmers that would move out there if we kind of kept going and unusual. And he ran up, of course, against manifest destiny.
What was his vision of the American West?
He really did feel that the Earth's resources in the West were for Americans to fulfill their destiny. I mean, he was certainly a man of his times. But he did feel that we had to do it in a sustainable way because otherwise things would really start building up and going wrong, right? So when he looked at water and he you know, it's one thing to look at the West and say, oh, yeah, it's arid. Okay, well, what do you do with that in terms of thinking about, okay, how do you do water? Well, he wanted to keep water within watersheds. He wanted to keep control of water locally and tied to the land. So he was very much interested in some very savvy law that would relate to ownership of the water. So he would be horrified now to think about us moving water hundreds and hundreds of miles over mountains and all like that.
Obviously, his thoughts and visions didn't pan out. So what happened there?
So what he was doing really was perceived by a lot of the boosters of the American West as being anti-progress, that he was standing in the way of whatever you want to call it, the American dream, the great move, the great fulfillment, the great realization of America coming out and developing this whole new land, the American West, which was so different from the East. And he, you know, would go blue in the face telling people that that's not what he was trying to do. But again, the tide was so strong. And that's what he had been really arguing about was, yes, let's develop, but let's just do it sensibly. And let's pay attention. Let's do the maps. Let's figure it out. Let's do this. Let's not just go kind of heedlessly out there as though it's, you know, just kind of there for us to be, you know, to take.
I've been joined by John F. Ross. He's a historian and author of The Promise of the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell's Perilous Journey and His Vision for the American West. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
October is coming to a close, which means Halloween is just around the corner, and spooky stories are on the agenda. A little more than a decade ago, Joe Donnell was working as a park ranger in the Wasatch Cache National Forest in northwest Utah. One of his responsibilities was managing the trail grooming program for the National Forest, meaning he'd be high up in the mountains in a snowcat, a vehicle that can move on snow.
You know, sometimes you were at 9,000, 10,000 feet and you knew there wasn't another person within probably 30 miles of you. So yeah, it was kind of, you know, if you believe in ghosts and monsters and all that, it'd be a little spooky at times, but it never bothered me, so. It happened in about 2005 or 2006. I was also with Search and Rescue. So we got a call about a car they found up at the Pass Lake Trailhead, which is all the way up by Mirror Lake on Highway 150. It's about 10,000 feet in elevation. And we got a call of a car that was up there, and it had snowed about 3 or 4 feet of snow. So we actually went up to that trailhead, which is up just past Mirror Lake. We found the car. We knew the lady, we knew her history, and she had a history of trying to harm herself in the past. So we thought there was something fishy. I don't remember if there was a note in the car or not, but we went up and we searched for her. We never found her. Because of the deep snow, we left the car there and it stayed there all winter. And I had actually been grooming past that trailhead several times that winter, probably half a dozen times I had been past that particular trailhead. And the trailhead is just a turnoff that goes back like 100 yards to a parking lot, and that's where the car was at. So when I was driving past that area, I could never see the car. It was well off the road, but I had been past that trailhead several times during that winter. And then one night I was grooming, I think it was about midnight, probably a full moon, and I was actually coming up to the turnoff to where the car was parked, because the car was still there. And I remember it got chilly in the snowcat, and it got, all of a sudden, I got the sense that I wasn't alone anymore. I mean, the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I just thought, wow, this is weird. And then the passenger side of the snowcat, there was an actual seat over there, passenger seat. It just got bright. And I didn't look over. I didn't want to know what was over there. I didn't really care to. So I kept driving past the trailhead, and I got about maybe 100 yards past the other side of the trailhead, and everything went away. It all went back to normal. And that just really kind of spooked me out, really was kind of creepy. So, of course, the next time I went past that same trailhead, I was thinking, okay, it's going to happen again. And it never happened again. Even though I was constantly thinking about it, that whole winter went by and it never happened again. And I'm not crazy. It just happened. I'm not sure I believe in ghosts or not, but the odd thing is that there was another ranger that was running the snowcat for us that same winter. And he just recently, I'd say maybe 5 years ago, he fessed up that the exact same thing had happened to him.
That was Joe Donnell. That story was produced by Aaron Jones and by me, Caroline Ballard. You can hear more stories of the supernatural on an upcoming episode of Human Nature. Find it at wyomingpublicmedia.org under the podcast tab.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. In addition to our other podcasts, you can hear the full program or individual segments at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also follow us on social media. Find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
And as a reminder, we love hearing your story ideas. You can send them through Facebook or on our website.
Anna Rader is our web editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.